right, good morning, everyone. I have no idea what Elden Ring, but it is time. So we definitely need to get cranky. We are in Titus. If everybody wants to turn there. And last class, we talked about how Titus has his hands full trying to deal with preaching the gospel on a very difficult island, the island of Crete. Very wicked island, full of liars, full of people out for nothing but selfish gain. And really, they don't care how they gain, as long as they gain. And this is kind of the attitude that Titus is going to have to deal with. And of course, the solutions to dealing with the wickedness on the island is twofold. One, to teach the gospel so that people can learn about the grace of Jesus Christ, that can transform their lives and help them live sensibly. Right, and also help make them zealous for good works. Right? This is the power of the grace of Christ that Titus is going to teach him about. But then what was the second solution? What was the second way that Titus would deal with the wicked people on the island of Crete? Other than teaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's a very specific step. V?
Shut them up.
Okay, yeah.
Stop them from what they were doing.
Okay, and how will you go about doing that?
Well, he's going to teach the people in the church about how to deal with work with relationships in the church and outside of the church and in the community. Right?
Okay, that's true. I guess I would throw that under, you know, just teaching people about the Lord, about the gospel.
Appoint elders,
right? That's how he was going to shut the false teachers up. He's going to put true teachers in place who had the ability to refute those who contradict these false teachers. And Titus, of course, would have to, you know, confront them as well. And, of course, your answer was right as well, David. So all of these things are what Titus is going to have to do, and he's going to need the grace of the Lord to do that. After listing the qualifications for elders, in verse 9, he lays out the twofold purpose of elders. One is to encourage Christians, right, to stay in the true doctrine, but then the second is to refute those who contradict. And what we're going to do this morning is read verses 10 through 16, and it's a description of those who contradict. We're going to learn about a little bit more about the false teachers this morning. Before we start, we're going to go ahead and have a prayer. And let's see. I don't always remember who's willing to lead prayers. Joshua?
Sure. Dear God, Father in heaven, we humbly bow before you this morning, so thankful for this opportunity that we have to be gathered here to open up your word and study a portion from it. We ask at this time that you be with Brian as he has prepared the lesson for us today, that we might be able to reflect upon these words that you have given us and be able to apply them to our lives so that we can have a better, closer relationship with you as we strive to serve you, strive to be more like your Son. For there are many things in this world that distract us, and we just ask that you would help us and strengthen us during these times, that we can put everything we have before you and put our lives in your hands so that you may guide us and guard us and direct us in everything that we do. In your Son's precious name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Thank you. So I know on your worksheets I had you read through chapter 2, verse 1. I was kind of going back and forth as to whether I should attach 2:1 to this section as kind of a contrast, or whether I should just save it and wait. And I flip-flop back and forth on that. And I decided to go back to my original plan, which is this morning we're just going to cover 10 through 16. And then we won't cover 2:1 until next class. So let's read then 10 through 16. This is a description of those who contradict true teaching. He says, "For there are many rebellious men, empty talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision, who must be silenced because they are upsetting whole families, teaching things they should not teach for the sake of sordid gain. One of themselves, a prophet of their own, said, 'Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons.' This testimony is true. For this reason, reprove them severely, so that they may be sound in the faith, not paying attention to Jewish myths and commandments of men who turn away from the truth. To the pure, all things are pure, but to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure, but both their mind and their conscience are defiled. They profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny him, being detestable and disobedient and worthless for any good deed. Let's have a review, okay, of the background of these false teachers. I would ask for the main sections, but really there's only one main section, and that's 10 to 16. And it's about the false teachers, okay? I want to review these false teachers a little bit, since it's been a little while since we talked about them. Since Paul writes this letter around the same time as 1 Timothy, and since Paul uses a lot of the same exact language to describe the false teachers here that he used back in 1 Timothy, it seems like he's dealing with the same false teaching. And that is an early form of Jewish Gnosticism, okay? Kind of a mixture of Judaism and Gnosticism. It's probably originated with which Jewish sect? Remember? Probably the Essenes. They were like Jewish monks. You had the Pharisees, you had the Sadducees, and you had the Essenes. Right? And they were like Jewish monks who lived in kind of exclusive communities, separate from everyone else. It's probably why you don't really read about them in the Gospels. Jesus doesn't really come across them because, you know, they were kind of in their own little world, okay? And they viewed themselves as the most holy sect among the Jews, and they were big into asceticism, this idea of kind of depriving your body of physical pleasure through rigid rules and regulations. Okay, they didn't believe that they should get married. You know, they denied themselves of sexual pleasure. Probably also food restrictions, whether it's Law of Moses food restrictions or even more severe, perhaps, of kind of a really thin diet, like a small diet. Like we need to not fulfill our bellies in any way. Okay? And so you combine that kind of mentality with Gnosticism, which is kind of pulls from Greek ideas about this dichotomy between the flesh and the spirit. That the flesh and the spirit are enemies, and that anything fleshly, anything in this material world is evil. But the spirit is good. Okay? And they also believe that the key to salvation was found in hidden secret knowledge. Hey, that other people didn't have. This, I think, was what formed the false teaching that both Timothy and Titus were having to deal with in that particular time period. Now remember, the Essenes wrote their own writings, lots of their own writings, about characters from the Old Testament and stories about those characters. Books like the Book of Jubilees, the Book of Enoch, the Book of Noah, the Testament of Levi, the Words of Moses, etc. And it may be that man-made stories like these are what Paul refers to in Titus 1:14 as Jewish myths. And in chapter 3, verse 9, as endless genealogies. Oh, he doesn't say endless there. He does that in 1 Timothy. But genealogies. Okay, genealogy basically means origin stories. Okay. I read you the account of Noah's birth. Remember that in our 1 Timothy class from the book of Enoch. They had this very detailed description of the birth of Noah. And of course, the Bible doesn't really tell us about the birth of Noah, but they had a lot to say on that. I want to give you another really interesting example from the book of Enoch, all right, about the Jewish concept of the origin of evil spirits on the earth. Right? And I'm choosing this particular account. You'll see why I'm choosing this particular account. It's for a very specific purpose. But remember, there's a really strange story or account in Genesis chapter 6 where it seems like the sons of God came down and dwelt and intermarried with the daughters of men. And there are a couple different positions on that, but it seems like angels from heaven actually came down to the earth and inhabited with the women of the earth. It's kind of like, well, you know, we don't know much detail on that. Why in the world did that happen? Why did they do that? And then, as a result of their marriage, what sort of people came about from that? Yeah, the giants. Okay, giants in the land came from this union between angels and women. Well, of course, the Bible only gives you like 4 verses about that. It doesn't really say much. Jude mentions it, but only briefly. The Jews had a lot to say about it, though. Okay, they kind of filled in a lot of the blanks about that account. So, for instance, they believed that when these angels came down, one of the head evil angels was named Azazel. Okay? And these angels came down not only to marry these women, but to reveal hidden secret knowledge to them. So, for instance, in the book of Enoch, chapter 9 and verse 6, it says, Thou seest what Azazel hath done, who hath taught all unrighteousness on earth and revealed the eternal secrets which were preserved in heaven, which men were striving to learn. Scholars say that some of that knowledge that they revealed would be about sexuality, about weaponry, about magic, astrology, makeup, alchemy, which is an early form of chemistry, okay, and metalworking. Then in another excerpt, we learn that the Jews believed it was through the birth of these giants that evil spirits entered the earth and started first dwelling upon the earth and spread their evil to mankind. All right, and listen to what, in this account, all right, God says to these angels, or watchers, as they're called, who left heaven to marry these earthly women. All right. And by the way, I hope as I'm reading this, you get tired of this. All right? I hope you're not, you know, I hope you're thinking, man, when's he going to get to the Bible? That's the point of what I'm, anyway. So, Book of Enoch, all right, chapter 15, verses 6 through 11 says this, you who were formerly spiritual, he's talking to the angels here, living the eternal life and immortal for all generations of the world, and therefore I have not appointed wives for you. For as for the spiritual ones of the heaven, in heaven is their dwelling. And now the giants, who are produced from the spirits and flesh, shall be called evil spirits upon the earth, and on the earth shall be their dwelling. Evil spirits have proceeded from their bodies, because they are born from men, and from the holy watchers, which is the angels, is their beginning and primal origin. They shall be evil spirits on earth, and evil spirits shall they be called. And as for the spirits of heaven, in heaven shall be their dwelling. And as for the spirits of the earth, which were born upon the earth shall be their dwelling. And the spirits of the giants afflict and oppress and destroy and attack, do battle and work destruction on the earth and cause trouble. They take no food, but nevertheless hunger and thirst and cause offenses. And these spirits shall rise up against the children of men and against the women because they have proceeded from them. Okay. And I'll read one more passage from this. This is a short one. But remember, according to Genesis 5, Enoch was taken straight to heaven. He didn't die like everybody else. Well, according to this account, those wicked angels who left heaven to come and intermarry these women, when God condemned them for it, they asked Enoch to intercede on their behalf with God. Because Enoch was up in heaven, right? So they wanted him to mediate for them. But despite Enoch's mediation, God refused to forgive them. And they ended up being judged. And so listen to this last section about what an angel says to Enoch. Uriel said to me, here shall stand the angels who have connected themselves with women, and their spirits, assuming many different forms, are defiling mankind and shall lead them astray into sacrificing to demons as gods. Here they shall stand till the day of the great judgment, in which they shall be judged till they are made an end of. And the women also of the angels who went astray shall become sirens. And I, Enoch, alone saw the vision, the ends of all things, and no man shall see as I have seen. Okay, so here's something interesting. I doubt this was the original intention when they were writing these things, but even just in these three short excerpts, which I chose for a purpose, you see an emphasis on three things. Origin stories, okay, what's the origin of evil spirits? Okay, well, Jews had an answer for that. You also see secret knowledge being revealed, and you also see an exclusiveness about knowing that secret knowledge. So, for instance, you see the secret knowledge when the watchers come down, the angels come down and reveal the secret knowledge to men. Then you also see the exclusiveness when Enoch at the very end says, no man shall see as I have seen. So my question is this, can you see how over time groups of Jews might latch on to this idea of having secret eternal knowledge that no one else knows about except them and God, and maybe fostering some sense of superiority okay, over those who don't have the knowledge of these origins and who God really is and where all these things came from. Honestly, it's hard to know exactly what secret knowledge these early Gnostics were selling because they did such a good job of hiding it. Scholars really don't know all the details, right, of what they were teaching. But we do have a lot of writings from a later developed form of Gnosticism in the second century. And you see those in books like the Gospel of Judas and the Gospel of Philip or the Revelation of Peter, which are all Gnostic writings in the second century. Okay, long after 1st and 2nd Timothy, and they're all very backwards from the Bible, those accounts. They're all very disturbing. And so even though those writings weren't around when Timothy and Titus were written, they all give us clues that these false teachers were teaching their own version of Christianity, okay, and their own version of the Bible. And here's my other question. After reading these accounts, how do you all feel right now? I mean, do you all feel any closer to God as a result of knowing kind of the Watcher thing and the giants and the angels and the Enoch intercept? I mean, do you feel like that helped you grow in your love for one another? You feel like that helped you in cleansing your conscience and having a better conscience? Or did it help you grow in your faith at all? No. And that's the point. That's why Paul calls them in verse 10, empty talkers. And that's why I was kind of hoping, as I read those sections, some of you were kind of thinking, really, I keep learning about this. Because it is kind of empty, right? It's interesting to me. I'm fascinated by it. I think it's pretty interesting that these Jews wrote these things. But in terms of actual spiritual value, helping us grow in spiritual maturity, they do nothing for that. They just don't. And sometimes I wonder if that's why God didn't give us that much information about those things. Because he just knew, you don't need to know, right? Well, why didn't God tell us about the birth account of Noah? Because we didn't need to know that. Not important, okay, in the grand scheme of things. But it seems like these Jews made things that were not that important to God very important, that we need to know about all these things. And Paul says it's just emptiness and speculation. Questions or comments about any of that? Mary?
Just a quick comment. It reminds me of in the 70s or 80s, I read this book called The Late Great Planet Earth. And it was all emphasis on knowing when the end was going to come and what was going to happen so that you could be prepared for it.
Yeah. We're, you know.
And that doesn't help you, brother.
Exactly. We're humans are suckers for secret information.
Mm.
We want that inside track. We want to know. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later. I don't want to say too much more about that, but that's a really good point. Okay. I know that was a big monologue. Let's now kind of get into the text and maybe get a little more participation from you all. He calls them in verse 10 empty talkers, right? So they say a lot, but the things they say really lack substance. They're of little spiritual value, and especially the Jewish false teachers. He says especially those of the circumcision. Now, here's a question. Are these men who are mistaken and they need someone like Aquila and Priscilla to come along and kind of show them the way of God more accurately? Is that how you would describe them? No.
I feel like they're Jewish. They're Christians.
Okay.
They haven't let go of all their history.
Yeah, I mean, what if someone like Aquila and Priscilla said, hey, look, we would like to show you the way of God more accurately. How would that go?
They'd say, we don't need it.
Yeah, I don't get the impression that they're looking for truth at all. Paul says they're rebellious. He calls them that in verse 10. These are rebellious men. They are deceivers, right? Which essentially means they know the truth already. They just refuse to obey it.
I think they're self-deluded. I mean, they've convinced themselves that what they believe is true.
Okay.
And that it would be almost impossible to turn them around.
Yeah, could be, yeah. And they're, you know, it's hard to know all their motives, you know, but they're certainly in it for money, you know, we know that. Later on it says they're in it for sordid gain. It's interesting, they pervert the truth, they don't submit to God, and they purposely deceive people. It's kind of like Satan. I mean, he's describing these people as Satan, essentially. Joshua, did you have something?
I was just going to point out what you did. It starts with rebellious, so...
Yeah.
It's
not like Apollos, right? In Acts 18, who, he was genuine and cared about the Lord. He just only knew about the baptism of John. And so when Aquila and Priscilla came, he was like, I need to teach the baptism of Jesus. I get the impression, these are men who know the truth, but they absolutely refuse to obey. And the solution Paul gives is not, well, you need to send an Aquila and Priscilla and help them see the light. His solution is shut them up. You have to silence them. Pretty politically incorrect solution, okay? But God takes error very seriously. Debbie?
So, do you think these are people who are actually... This is confusing to me. It doesn't seem like they would be people who would be coming to worship with the Christians there. They've got a whole other... Is he talking about the people like in the community?
It is a
debate. Are they filtering in sometimes standing around at the outside? Because they got a whole different way of thinking about things.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a debate. It may be a debate whether these are actual Christians in their midst. Because when you ask the question, well, how do you silence them? Well, obviously there would be two different solutions. If they're actually a part of your group, then silencing means withdrawing from them. And of course, the elders that Titus appoints, would help take the lead in that, right? You're withdrawing from them. We can't have fellowship with you anymore. But if these are maybe people who consider themselves Christians, but they're just kind of traveling around, teaching these things and going from house to house, trying to spread their doctrine, because Paul does say they're upsetting whole families, so they are going around. And of course, churches met in homes as well. So that is a good question. And I don't know that we can know that for sure. In every case, are these people that actually are members of that congregation and it's coming from within, or are they just trying to kind of infiltrate the churches and maybe they come and visit for a while and they make comments, in Bible class to try to throw people off, or maybe they say, look, you pay us and we'll teach the Bible class and we'll teach you all the secret knowledge that you really need to know for a small fee. If that's the case, then silencing them would mean you lock your door and you don't let them in your house. Right? You stop letting them in the church at all and in the first place. Okay? So that's a really good question. But these people are destroying households. I don't like the New American Standard, honestly, on this English translation where they say upsetting whole families. Upsetting, that kind of sounds like, oh, they're making people sad. They're going in and people are just angry, or he's making people cry. Upsetting means to flip upside down, to destroy.
Mine says ruining.
Yeah, ruining. That's a much better translation. Much better translation.
But then why does he say in verse 13, rebuke them that they may be sound in faith?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
That led me to believe that they were at least members or...
Yeah,
there are people who have expressed an interest or converted.
Yeah, I think these are people who probably were baptized, consider themselves Christians, but they had their own version that sounded really good on the surface, but was really junk. And the only way to get through to them, that hopefully, they would change. The only way to get through to them would not be with the typical kind of, like, let's just have a Bible study. They would need to be disciplined. I mean, they need to be reproved severely. That same word is used in Romans where it says God, you need to know the kindness and severity of God. I mean, this is a severe rebuke of these false teachers. Dave?
It was like in Galatians, you had the Judaizing teachers that came in and snuck in among them and embedded themselves and taught things that weren't right.
Yeah.
They weren't members of the congregation necessarily, or you had those in Corinth where Paul talks about, they have letters of recommendation, they've come in, they've influenced, they've been accepted.
Good.
And then Paul didn't have any other letter, but of course it was written in their hearts. But there was common for teachers to come in and have their influence over the congregation without actually being part of that local.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You could have just been kind of itinerant, traveling around, spreading these things. And, maybe it's good to think, well, how did their teaching destroy families? How did it upset or flip upside down or ruin entire households? Think about it this way. What did the Gnostics teach about Jesus? Remember is generally.
That he was not, he had not come in the flesh.
Yeah, he's not really the Son of God in the flesh. That because remember, the flesh is evil and spirit is good. So that means there's no way God could come down and dwell in flesh. That's the most ridiculous thing they would have ever heard in their way of thinking. And they also believe that Jesus was not crucified for us, right? Which really is the complete opposite of the gospel message that exactly. These families had come to believe in the first place. If you deny the crucifixion of Jesus, think about all that else you're denying. You're denying that we actually needed him to die for our sins. And that was the other thing that got that the Gnostics said. The Gnostics believe sin is not our real problem. Our real problem is a lack of special knowledge. As long as you have this insider knowledge about, you know, the truths about God and spirituality and bodily discipline and all of that stuff, that's how you'd be saved. So you can see how just very upsetting and disturbing that would be, you know, to people in that first century world. Okay, and you know, it may help to understand that a lot of us are educated, you know, highly educated. We've all been to college, most of us, and we're just more educated in our society. We've got YouTube, we've got articles online we can read. You know, we have all these things, and you got to think, you have these simple people in the first century, many just common folk. I mean, I understand maybe there were some rich who could afford, you know, higher education and things like that, but, you know, many people were illiterate, you know, and then you have these people coming in claiming to be somebody. Hey, look, we're teachers. You should listen to us. We have the knowledge, and we'll help you as long as you'll pay us for it. You can see how, even though it seems weird, like we think, why would they even listen to them? That's just the dumbest thing ever. They just didn't have all the advantages we have. They didn't have the entire Bible, right, like we do, and mm-hmm. and so they didn't necessarily have all the advantages that we have in that. And they may have been a little more gullible. And of course, a part of Gnostic teaching would be too, since our bodies are evil, we either have to punish them and deprive them of all pleasure, or the other extreme, we can just do whatever we want with our bodies. They're evil, so we might as well go ahead and do evil. Those were the two consequences of that Gnostic belief, at least.
This is saying, to the pure, all things are pure, but to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. This is verse 15.
Mm-hmm.
But even their mind and conscience are defiled.
So, you know, it's interesting. They may consider themselves believers of some kind, but Paul says they're actually unbelievers because they don't believe Jesus was in the flesh. I mean, that is the very thing that John describes as the Antichrist. Anybody who denies that Jesus came in the flesh is the Antichrist. That's exactly what these Gnostics would believe. And of course, 1 John was written against Gnosticism as well, heavily, heavily against Gnosticism. Really good point. And you can just see how this would destroy families when it comes in. And so I want to just note that combating these false teachers is one of the main reasons Paul said to appoint elders in every city. And you'll notice that many of the qualifications for elders are the exact opposite character qualities of the false teachers. Did you all find direct contrasts between the elders and the false teachers? I actually found 9 of them. Maybe you all... I always struggle to get to 10. My evangelism class was hilarious. All of my lists were 9. 9 truths about it. I couldn't get to 10. I only found 9. But anybody find any direct contrasts? Just throw them out there. Direct contrast between false teachers and elders.
One's blameless.
Okay, one's blameless.
Not accused of dissipation or rebellion, and then any rebellious.
Yeah, and then he says they're rebellious.
And rebellion.
Elders are not accused of rebellion, but the false teachers are rebellious. What else? Anybody get any others? Debbie?
One says holding firmly to the trustworthy message, and the other was mere talkers and deceivers.
Good, yeah, absolutely. Empty talkers versus sound doctrine. Mm-hmm. Right? False teachers teach for sordid gain, mm-hmm. and elders, it says, are not to be fond of sordid gain. I mean, mm-hmm. it's the exact same language there.
Mm-hmm.
False teachers are evil beasts. Elders are sensible. Mm-hmm. False teachers are lazy gluttons. Elders are self-controlled. False mm-hmm. teachers are defiled in conscience. Elders mm-hmm. are devout. Mm-hmm. False teachers are disobedient. Elders are not self-willed. Mm-hmm. Okay? False teachers are worthless for any good deed, and elders love what is good. Anybody get any different ones than that?
I have not dissipated, not given wine.
Okay.
So, I mean, I look at dissipation as
sure.
that sort of thing.
Okay, sure. These are directly opposite. What?
There's 10.
Oh, all right. There's 10. Yeah, fantastic.
Did we say holding fast to the faithful word?
Yes.
In accordance with the teaching and then teaching what they should not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Good. All right. Well, together with our powers combined, we made 10. All right. So, an interesting question, and maybe this is what Debbie was getting at earlier. You know, how do you think these teachers were gaining from this? You know, if it's such a different gospel, how were they actually gaining? How were Christians paying them, you know, for their teachings? And it may have had something to do with what I said about education, but I think it also comes back to what Mary said earlier about this idea of secrets. I mean, in our culture, we're so much more skeptical because we have so many infomercials and so many claims now. But isn't it true? We just love to hear someone say, I have the secret to losing weight, or I have the secret to meet the man or woman of your dreams. And we'll pay them to tell us that secret, because we just want to know. And sometimes, we're not even going to use the information. We just want to know it. I'll just pay you to tell me. It's like magic trick. You know, somebody does a card trick, and you're just like, you have to tell me how you did that. And it's not because we're going to become a magician and we're going to go around doing it necessarily. We just want to know the secret. And if that magician said, look, pay me $10 and I'll show you, probably would, depending on how good the trick is, right? We want to know. And that if, and somebody says, look, you can meet the man or woman of your dreams for 3 easy payments of $19.99, we're going to break out the credit card because I just want to know the secret. Just tell me, right? And so I think there's a draw to the secrecy of the Gnostics. Go ahead, Jerry.
There was a program or movie that was out about 10 years ago called The Secret. Do you remember that? It was a big sensation.
Oh, I don't... Vaguely.
Talking to celebrities and everything. And
okay.
What it turned out to be was selling the law of attraction, which is, you know, you think about what you think about, you're going to attract to yourself.
So, oh, okay. Okay.
But that got a lot of popular following.
That's a good example. Yeah.
It was called The Secret.
That's the perfect thing to title it, right? Because everybody wants to know what the secret is.
When you go to a carnival, there will be the world's largest horse.
Oh.
And you can't see it unless you pay a dollar. The fact that he's hidden.
Yeah.
The only way
to see it.
The fact that he's hidden, you don't know how big he is. Like, how would that look in person? Think you really wanted it. Finally, this last time we went to the carnival, I'll tell you, though, I finally had to see the world's largest horse.
And were you?
It was huge.
It was? Okay. Well, at least they didn't disappoint you, because a lot of times you're disappointed once you finally learn what the secret is. You're like, oh,
yeah, well, it's only $1.
That. Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. It's like the Wizard of Oz. You know, we got to go see him. And then they get there, and it's like, not exactly who I thought he was. But it was a secret. It was something attractive. I got to go see him. He's going to tell me all the secrets of life, and he's going to help me with all these things. Also, let me say this, too. This is a very real thing, not only in human behavior, but, I mean, we see it in the first century world. If people are charging money for their services, isn't there an assumption that they must have something of value? Maybe that's a little lost on us again because of our culture. We're so used to scams and all that. I get that. But generally speaking, if somebody's charging for something, we know it's valuable. And the opposite is true, too. If somebody's giving away something for free, there's a little suspicion there that, well, if you're just giving it away, it's probably not that great. You know, if it's not good enough to charge people money for it, I don't know if I really want to buy into this. And I say that because this is exactly what happened to Paul in 2 Corinthians. Paul said, I didn't charge you all money back in 1 Corinthians. He said, look, I could have charged you all money, but I didn't. Because he didn't want the gospel to be hindered. He knew they were too spiritually immature, and they would have accused him of just being interested in money. So he refused to charge the Corinthians. Well, while he was working with them, remember he made tents while he was in Corinth, and then he accepted money from the Thessalonians, okay? Well, that backfired on him, because by time of 2 Corinthians, they basically thought, well, Paul is not charging us because, well, he doesn't really have anything, you know, worth buying. And the false apostles that had snuck in amongst their midst, they were charging. You know, hey, we got great services. We'll teach you the truth. You just pay us. And Paul, you know, he rebukes the Corinthians. They're like, was I doing you wrong? Like, was I a wrongdoer and an evildoer by not charging you money? You know, was there a problem? And Paul makes kind of, not makes fun of them, but uses a little bit of sarcasm, like, hey, you know, we're sorry that we didn't take advantage of you. You know, we could have taken advantage of you. We didn't, like these false teachers. We know you like to be taken advantage of. Sorry we didn't do that to you. So there is something to that, that perhaps because these false teachers were charging money, there was something else attractive about it as well. Those may be some factors. Okay, probably need to... Okay, we're doing okay. So, obviously, we learn that these false teachers were not interested in people's souls. You know? Verse 12, you know, just says, they're like the typical Cretan. Okay? According to their own prophet, Epimenides, liars, right? They're evil beasts. Right? They're like animals living by instinct, a dog-eat-dog instinct. And they're only interested in sensuality and filling their bellies. And that's why, verse 13, they need to be silenced. Severely rebuked. Okay. These verses are, again, very politically incorrect today. But it shows us, doesn't it, just how serious God takes error. And not just error, but people who purposely teach error, especially for money and for sordid gain. And I think this really helps us today to be sensitive to error and false teaching, because our culture desensitizes us to it. Not only because we're surrounded by false teaching, but because our culture tells us that there's nothing wrong with error, that there is no such thing as error, that truth is all relative, and so we're in this kind of postmodern pluralistic culture. And I think there's a danger, especially among younger Christians being raised in this culture, to over time care less and less about truth and care less and less about standing up against error. You know, that's from the 50s. We used to stand up in error in the 50s, but, you know, now we've kind of gotten past that. We can all just kind of get along no matter what we believe now, and it's no big deal. And it's just not what these texts tell us. It tells us God is very serious, that we need to be on the alert. We've been very blessed here at Palm Springs Drive to not have false teachers purposely creeping in, you know, and meeting these qualifications. I hear horror stories about these things, like in India, false teachers like this, you know, or in Seychelles. Sometimes Jimmy has had to combat people like this. And I'm looking at this text like, this is foreign to me. I've never met anybody like this. And that's a great blessing. But it doesn't mean that we might not be in danger of that, and we can just let our guard down and think, well, you know, we'll be fine, and nobody will ever creep in among us and teach what's not true. We need to be willing to silence those who are teaching false doctrine. That's hard, but it needs to be done.
And even,
questions or thought about any of that?
Well, even one-on-one, you know, I mean, if you can, just as people say things, just to say, not just to stand there and just go, well, yeah, you know, but just say that. That's not true, or that's not right, or that's not what's in the scriptures.
Yeah, those are things we don't hear very often, right? That's not true. I mean, how often do you hear that, you know, in a spiritual conversation? You know, it might be more like, well, I feel that it's this. And it's more opinions, more just whim, but not much objective truth.
Mm-hmm. And this week, I was talking to this lady, and she just was like, well, I'm spiritual, but I don't go to church. And I'm like, and she's like, well, and I believe in a bigger being or a whatever.
Higher
and I'm
being.
Like, but
higher power.
Thank you, a higher power. And I said, well, God can be known. He is known. Yeah. He has a voice, and he has ears, and he hears,
and he defines
speaks,
spirituality.
And he defines,
yeah.
And I said, that's just not true, you know.
Yeah. No, that's great. And sometimes we need to have those conversations. And we talk in our evangelism class about how to tactfully do that, you know, with questions and love and all that.
I copied a quote from one of the commentaries. It says, the way to heaven is blocked off by dead professors of religion.
That's pretty good.
That's true.
And doesn't Jesus
say... And they are teaching error in seminaries everywhere.
And even Jesus said that about the Pharisees, that not only are you being kept out of heaven, you're keeping other people out of heaven by your teaching. So, that's a really good point. Let me make sure to get to 15 and 16 here, because, let me just say about verse 14, the commandments of men, those are probably the same type that Paul was dealing with in 1 Timothy, like, you know, bodily regulations about marriage and eating certain foods, okay? But verse 15, an interesting verse, okay? To the pure, all things are pure, all right? And I was going to kind of ask around what you all thought that meant, but I probably should just give what I believe it means, and then we can comment if we have time. But it seems that these false teachers were using their bodily external regulations as their standard for purity and righteousness and holiness. And Paul is teaching them that true purity comes from within. When you are internally pure, because you're actually living a godly life, that means that all of these things that the false teachers are placing regulations on, like marriage and certain foods, all of those things are actually pure for you. Okay? It's very similar to the argument in 1 Timothy 4, where he says, look, as long as you're thanking God for your food and eating with a grateful heart and you're in prayer and you're in the Word of God, all these things are sanctified. All these things are holy and good for you. But the problem with the false teachers is that they are impure on the inside in their hearts. They're defiled. They're unbelievers. They've destroyed their consciences with evil. So in that case, it doesn't matter how many external bodily restrictions they put on themselves. They're never going to be holy, because holiness has to come from inside. Their hearts are ruined, and so nothing they do is pure, because their hearts are impure. Jesus says this the best. Look in Luke 12. The Pharisees, even though they weren't teaching Gnosticism, they had the same problem, where they were trying to be righteous from the outside in, with all the ceremonial washings and rituals and all that stuff. And Jesus says, then you need to be righteous from the inside out. And he says in Luke 11:37. Now when he had spoken, a Pharisee asked him to have lunch with him, and he went in and reclined at the table. And when the Pharisee saw it, he was surprised that he had not first ceremonially washed before the meal. The Lord said to him, now you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but inside of you, you are full of robbery and wickedness. You foolish ones. Did not he who made the outside make the inside also? But give that which is within as charity, and then all things are clean for you. See, it's the same point. Jesus says, once you purify yourself from the inside, you have a heart of charity and generosity and giving and a heart that's in line with God, then you don't have to worry about washing your hands before you eat your food. Your food is clean, okay? Because your heart is clean. And I'll tell you, we can fall into that same trap as Christians, an external righteousness trap, that I'm holy because, well, I go to church, and I read my Bible, and I do all these good works, and those are all good things. But if internally we don't love the Lord, and we're not really interested in obeying Him, doing His will, then going to church does us no good. Doing all good works, it does us no good. In fact, I think that's why he says in verse 16, these false teachers are worthless for any good deed, because they become so defiled that they couldn't even do a good deed if they tried, if they wanted to. And I think probably another part of that is they don't even want to do good deeds, and that's probably another reason why they're disqualified for good works. They profess to know God. Remember, Gnosticism is from the root word gnosis, which is knowledge. He says they proclaim to know the secrets about God. He says, but by their life, they completely contradict that claim that they know God. They live like they don't. And that's why 1 John, he makes that point over and over again. He who claims that he knows God and yet does not keep his commandments does not know God at all. The word know is used over and over again in 1 John. He's combating these Gnostics, and Paul's talking about the same thing. Comments or questions about any of that? I think you got 2 minutes.
that whole idea is just—it's just so prevalent today. I mean, really, look at all the people that go to church, and yet the minute they leave church, they're bad mouthing other people, and they're, you know, they're using the Lord's name in vain, and they're cursing, and they're you know, cheating on their taxes, and yet they think they're okay because they're going to church every Sunday or whatever.
Yeah, we need to change our hearts and allow the grace of Jesus and the gospel to do that. And then our works will be pleasing to the Lord. All right. Well, thank you all very much. And we'll pick up chapter 2 on Wednesday.